Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's November 19th. This is our second lecture on blood flow, cardiac output, blood pressure, that kind of stuff. All right, and let's take a look at the schedule really quick after I get those lights down. Recording, the lectures so far are online. Got them up there last night, and then I'll try to get this one online fast as well. All right, so we were talking about some hormones, in particular three hormones, that help adjust blood flow and blood volume. Probably blood volume is the way that they operate. And these three hormones are antidiuretic hormone, otherwise known as, what is antidiuretic hormone? How do we usually talk about it? ADH. That's right, ADH. But guess what? It's got another name. Thank you, vasopressin. Did everybody catch that? I should go down the list and ask everybody. Okay, I'm recording, so I can't call you by name. But yes, ADH and vasopressin are the same. And then aldosterone and atrial natriuretic hormone. And I'm sorry, my cursor isn't going to be working here, so I got to do something about it and show. I was able to get it working pretty good. Last time, pointer options, arrow options, visible. Okay, now how do I get this to go full screen? Did I do this? No. We had it really nice last time. Okay, let me do that. No. Nope. Let me play with it just a little bit more. Did it go over here? Ah, there's where it went. Okay. And I still have pointer options visible. 2 and 2. Two and two. All right. Hey, college education is great. Okay, we figured this out. Okay, so we're talking about these three hormones, right? And basically these things adjust blood pressure by adjusting fluid volumes in your body. And when blood pressure is adjusted, so is blood flow. That's the most important consideration because blood flow is what brings nutrients and oxygen to tissues. It's not really pressure, but it's the flow of blood, right? But in order for something to flow, there has to be pressure, right? So any kind of fluid will only flow from high pressure to low pressure. And that's the job of the heart, is to put a big pressure gradient across the a circulation, whether it's systemic or pulmonary circulation. And arterial blood vessels have high pressure, venous blood vessels have low blood pressure, so blood is going to flow from arteries into veins and then back into the heart. All right, so we talked about these three hormones, and you should know which ones are synergistic and which ones are antagonistic to each other. We did a pretty good job of that. And so here is vasopressin, how it works. I don't think I want to go over that once again, but maybe this one right here, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, right? This is a very important mechanism, and what's it doing? What is it adjusting? What is it adjusting? Yeah, blood pressure regulation in the long term, right? Long-term blood pressure regulation, not second to second, like when you change body position, but in the long term, because we're talking about some hormones and some other factors that are in the blood that maybe take a little while to have an effect, but things that take a while to have an effect have a more long-lasting effect. That just seems to be the way it always goes. All right, so there's angiotensin in the blood. Is it there all the time? I'm sorry, angiotensinogen. Is angiotensinogen in the blood all the time? And the answer is yes. And what kind of form is it in, active or inactive? It's inactive because you see this ogen. All right, well, there are kidneys that have pressure receptors, and there's also a way that the kidney can measure blood flow. And
If there's decreased pressure or flow through the kidneys, they release a compound called renin, and that compound is an enzyme. It goes into the blood, and it has an active site for angiotensinogen, and it will cleave angiotensinogen into one. Now, angiotensin 1 is in the blood, and it has some activity, but it's not the major actor. The major actor is angiotensin 2. And there has to be an enzyme that converts angiotensin 1 into 2, and that's called angiotensin converting enzyme, otherwise known as ACE. And this ACE pretty much is in the lungs, right? And then angiotensin 2 has a couple effects, right? It goes to the adrenal cortex, and it causes the release of aldosterone, which then goes to the kidneys. So here's that aldosterone, the hormone, goes to the kidneys, and it will increase resorption of both salt and water by the kidneys. Right? So when we say resorption, which way are these components moving according to the tubular elements that you know about in the kidney? Resorption from a tubular element, which has filtrate, into a vascular element, right? Well, we didn't go over kidneys yet, but that's just kind of a quick review from anatomy, right? So review your nephron anatomy. And when the kidneys resorb salt and water, that increases blood volume, and of course we see that that subtracts from the initial stimulus. And when we increase blood volume, right, let's take a one more step further, what happens to blood pressure? Okay, if we increase blood volume, The pressure, okay, think of your car tire. And your car tire is kind of flat, right? You put air in, or do you take out air to get pressure up? Put air in or take air out? You put air in, right? And so kind of just use that analogy. Same thing for blood pressure. If we put fluid in, blood pressure is going to increase, right? And, okay, I'll leave it at that. For now. Okay, another effect of angiotensin 2 causes vasoconstriction of arterioles. That also increases blood pressure, right? Because this vasoconstriction is a way of increasing resistance in blood vessels, resistance to blood flow, and sometimes we call that total peripheral resistance. So total peripheral resistance increases, that's going to increase blood pressure. And I'm going to show you why that happens in just a little bit. So, hypertension is epidemic in the United States, and this is the mechanism that physicians try to manipulate to bring somebody's blood pressure back down, right? Because this is the long-term regulator of blood pressure. So the first thing to do is to decrease blood volume. What could you prescribe for somebody to reduce their blood volume? Diuretics, right? Get rid of some fluid, all right? And if we can prevent the conversion of one into angiotensin 2 with an ACE inhibitor, right, that would inhibit the rest of this mechanism down here, that's useful. Or we could have an angiotensin 2 receptor blocker on the adrenal cortex. And then these other things work by directly on the heart, not this mechanism right here, like beta blockers in the heart, calcium channel blockers in the heart, right, and these alpha 2 agonists. They work very powerfully, but they're not on this particular list. All right, so this is the dreaded renin angiotensin aldosterone mechanism. And definitely pay really close attention. And is this an exam figure by any chance? Yeah, okay, so I would maybe draw that out a couple of times to make sure that you can follow the flow. All right, we ended up talking about atrial natriuretic hormone. So when the atria stretch, they release this hormone. And both natriuretic hormone together with decreased ADH acts in negative feedback to lower blood pressure, right? So ANP is antagonistic to both ADH and aldosterone. So if we have increased blood volume, maybe by drinking too much water, right, increased blood volume, we have a lot more fluid moving back to the heart. So we're not thinking about concentration of the blood or anything, just a volume of blood. So we have increased venous return because blood volume increased. So the atria receive more fluid, so they fill up more, which means that they stretch. So there's an increase in stretch. As a result of that stretch, well, there are stretch receptors in the atria, right? And then as a result of that, then the atria secrete ANP. ANP goes to the kidneys to increase both sodium and water excretion. Right, so we're going to be losing water and salt. That's going to increase urine volume, right? So this ANP is acting like a, what kind of pharmaceutical? A diuretic, right? So we're comparing ADH, an antidiuretic, with ANP, which is a diuretic. So you'd expect the opposite results, and indeed that's what we get. So we get increased urine volume, and it might be dilute, might not be, right? But certainly increased volume. So that takes volume out of the blood, right? And that decreases venous return, and so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining homeostasis. All right, the other thing that the stretch of the left atrium does, stimulates the vagus nerve, goes to the brain, right? And then the brain tells the posterior pituitary via the hypothalamus to decrease ADH secretion. All right, so the stretch of the atrium, there are efferent nerve fibers in the atria, and those signals get in to the central nervous system via the vagus nerve. All right, so receptor, and then we got afferent pathway, we've got the integration center, and then the efferent pathway is what, that hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, which goes down to the posterior pituitary, and then there's a decrease in ADH secretion, okay, which then decreases water resorption in the kidney. Both of these effects right here. So that is going to lower blood pressure as a result. All right, so those are those three hormones. Anybody got a question about those three? Just really look over that renin, angiotensin, aldosterone mechanism. Know which ones are active, which ones are sort of active. Know which ones are really active, which ones are enzymes, which ones are hormones, that kind of stuff. All right, okay. All right, so let's look about some factors affecting blood flow. And maybe I'll turn the lights on for just a second. So how is it that a fluid will flow from one place to another? What's got to happen? Okay, diffusion. Yeah, that's concentration gradient, right? So diffusion, but I really want to see something flow, not just kind of migrate from one place to another. Okay. Pressure is going to be equal to a couple things. Sorry. Blood flow through any place is going to be like movement of fluid from one place to another. There's got to be a difference in pressure. Right? So if we increase pressure, what's going to happen to blood flow? Directly related, right? You could just tell me that and then I know, right? Increase one, the other is going to increase. All right, but in real-world situations, there's always some resistance to that blood flow. And we're going to see it depends on the diameter of a blood vessel and a number of things, maybe the viscosity of blood. All right, and so something that's going to impede blood flow is called resistance. So this is a really nice, simple equation. I think you should have an intuitive idea of what's happening here. All right, so if we increase resistance, what happens to blood flow? It goes down, right? Resistance impedes blood flow. So this is a nice, simple relationship, right? So make sure that you could just write this down, right? Just remember this one. All right, what's another one that's really good to know? Maybe I'll put this down over here, and that is cardiac output. What is cardiac output equal to? Stroke volume times heart rate, okay? And what is this cardiac output? What is that really? What are the units of cardiac output? Volume per time, right? Volume per time, which is mLs per minute. All right, so this is mLs per minute right over here. And I haven't done this before. Let me think about this. Okay, blood flow, all right, so this is not a velocity. This is blood flow. And blood flow is also going to be in milliliters per minute. The blood flow. Okay, so it's volume. So what is speed? Speed of blood is equal to velocity. And what is that? Maybe I'll draw it right here. It is distance per time. All right, and we're using mLs over here, so let's use centimeters, because an mL is cubic centimeters. So distance over time would be centimeters per minute. All right, is centimeters per minute and mLs per minute the same? All right, this is what? Centimeters cubed, so that's not the same. So speed is a lot different than flow.
So flow is a volume per time. A velocity is just a distance per time. Okay. All right. So vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue or an organ. And so does the pressure, of course. Vasodilation decreases resistance. Vasoconstriction increases resistance. Let me see if I can turn just a couple of these lights off and still see the board. That's pretty good. All right, so resistance is adjusted by vasodilating or vasoconstricting. And this can be done with the sympathetic nervous system in some blood vessels. And so so the sympathetic nervous system is important. All right, if we just look at blood flow through various organs just for fun, right, we see that the kidneys take up almost one-fifth or 20% of all blood flow. Even though they're very small organs, right, the kidneys are very metabolic, and they're producing urine 24 hours a day and adjusting blood volume, electrolyte volume, and all kinds of other things. Right, so they demand a lot of blood flow. And what about the brain? Oh, the brain doesn't even get as much as your kidneys. Right, so that is sort of interesting. Skeletal muscles get a large percentage, and your digestive tract gets a large percentage as well. Right, but I really wanted to show you kidneys, how much blood flow they need, because they need a lot of ATP. And you make what's the best way to make ATP once again? With oxygen or without oxygen? With oxygen, yeah, aerobic respiration, right? So these kidneys need a lot of blood flow because they need a lot of oxygen. All right, so here is a vascular system. What do we got right here? We got the left side of the heart, right side of the heart. Here's a blood vessel that's coming off of the LV. Maybe you want to put LV right here, right? And so blood is flowing out this way. So what kind of vessel is this right here? That's an artery. Here we have blood flowing back into the heart. This is a vein, and I see a change in color right here, which means that's not on the slide, but here is a capillary bed where exchange can take place, and that's because capillaries are so thin and leaky. All right, so blood is going to flow through this circuit only if the left ventricle has higher pressure than the right atrium, and indeed it does. Right, and the pressure difference, we can measure the pressure in the left ventricle, right, and that pressure, an average is going to be 100 millimeters of mercury, right? We know also that it's systolic is a high pressure and a low pressure, so it is 120 over 80. But if we take the average or mean, it's basically just 100 millimeters of mercury, and the pressure in the right atrium is going to be zero. And maybe it's even a little bit less than atmospheric pressure. It could be 1 or 2 millimeters of mercury less. So in order to find out what the pressure difference is, then we just subtract these two numbers, and because we're interested in the change in pressure, the delta P, in this particular case, because the right atrium is zero, that's a really easy calculation, right? It's just determined by the pressure in this artery right here, or the mean pressure. So flow is going to be directly proportional to this pressure difference, and here's a really nice pressure difference. So what are the important things besides pressure? Well, what did I write on the board? Here's a basic equation. Blood flow is equal to pressure divided by the resistance to that blood flow. And resistance is directly related to the length of a blood vessel. So that means when the length of a blood vessel increases, what happens to resistance? It increases as well, right? And if we decrease the length of a blood vessel, then the resistance decreases, right? And so we know that the systemic circulation is a long circulation, so there's a lot of resistance in the systemic circulation. Pulmonary circulation is very short, so there's very little resistance, relatively speaking, in the pulmonary circulation. Also, I think it's intuitive to it is intuitive to see that if we increase the viscosity or the sludginess of blood, that also is going to contribute to resistance. And so if we increase viscosity, that increases resistance. And don't forget, here's where resistance is. It's in the denominator of this flow. So if we increase resistance, what happens to flow? It's inversely related, right? So it decreases. So if we increase viscosity, we're increasing R, what happens to blood flow? It's going to decrease. So I guess we'll talk about all these terms. Blood flow is also related
inversely proportional to the, what are we talking, oh, we're talking about resistance. Resistance is inversely proportional to the fourth power of the radius. Right? So here's the radius over here, and this equation is not what we're talking about on this line, because if we look at resistance and blood flow, how are they related in this relationship here? They're directly related, right? So if we increase the radius, right, what happens to blood flow? It increases. What this statement right here says, right, inversely proportional to the fourth power of the radius, we're talking about, okay, resistance right here. Right, so if we increase radius, then the resistance decreases. If we increase radius, blood flow increases because these are directly related to each other, but radius is inversely related to resistance. Okay?
Maybe a little bit confusing the way that it's said. All right, so this fourth power rule, and this is true for any kind of tube, not just blood vessels, is a very powerful controller of blood flow. Right, because if we double the diameter, double the radius of a blood vessel, what happens to blood flow? Right, we could change this from 1 to 2, right, and then blood flow would increase by 2, but not according to Poiseuille's law, because this radius right here, it turns into a 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, and I think that should be about 16, okay? So if there's a doubling in radius, there's a 16 times increase in blood flow. So small changes in the radius of a blood vessel have drastic changes in blood flow through that particular tube. All right, what else does that mean? Well, in order to regulate blood flow in your body, can your nervous system, endocrine system, or any system in your body change the length of a blood vessel? Can we change blood flow by increasing resistance by adjusting the length of a blood vessel? No, because these blood vessel lengths are pretty standard, right? They don't change. And what about viscosity? Does the viscosity of your blood go up and down? Maybe a little bit, but not very much. Only maybe in states of dehydration when your hematocrit goes way up under pathological conditions, but under normal circumstances, blood viscosity shouldn't change very much. Right? So you can't adjust blood flow by adjusting blood viscosity or by adjusting length. Right? It's only by adjusting the radius. Right? So what we see right here, okay, remember, blood flow is equal to pressure divided by resistance. Resistance is equal to this term here. Resistance is equal to, should I write that on the board? Okay, I can do that. Resistance is equal to, okay, it's a little weird. It's going to be equal to R to the fourth power times viscosity times length. Right, so if you increase length, what happens to resistance? Directly related, goes up. If you increase viscosity, directly related, resistance goes up. If you increase radius, resistance goes down by the fourth power. Okay, so this thing fits into this equation, so if you want to put this in this equation over here, you have to turn it upside down, right? That's why this R4 ends up in the numerator in that blood flow equation. All right, so I'm sure you go over this in lab pretty much, and then this pi over 8 are just some proportionality constants that we're not too interested in. This is Poiseuille's law. So what's the most important regulator of blood flow? Is the radius. That's right. And that can be changed by sympathetic nervous system. And the force that pushes blood through is the pressure gradient, the difference in pressure. Okay. That's pretty good. So here we have a plot of blood pressure versus various blood vessels right here, and we want to answer a couple of questions. What blood vessels have the highest blood pressure? What blood vessels have the lowest blood pressure? And we can look at this chart and find that out pretty easily, but you know what? I just want to ask you, what blood vessels have the lowest blood pressure? Just take a, what would your intuitive feeling be? Okay. And everybody said the right answer. I'm kind of floored because I think when I first started looking at this, I would say all capillaries have the lowest pressure. Well, capillaries are very significant because that's where exchange takes place, but they don't have the lowest pressure when we look at this total circulation. Indeed, large veins and the atria have the lowest pressure because otherwise, if capillaries had the lowest pressure, blood would flow into capillaries from arteries, blood would flow into capillaries from veins as well. Right? And that's not a good thing.
Okay, so we can see 120 over 0. This is ventricular pressure. Then in the aorta, we would see about 120 over 80. And then as we move down into smaller and smaller arteries and arterioles, the resistance to blood flow increases as the radius changes, and so the pressure starts to decrease and this pressure pulse goes away. And then finally, we're into capillaries, and there's a pressure difference on either side of the capillary, so blood flows through them, and then finally into veins and then back to the heart. All right, so what blood vessels have the highest blood pressure? Large arteries, not small arteries or arterioles. That's what we see right here. Well, capillaries are really important because that's where exchange takes place. And so if we have a capillary for exchange, once blood is in a capillary, should it scoot through very fast or should it kind of stay in a capillary, kind of wait around and allow for exchange to take place? So we're talking about speed, not flow, but just the speed of blood. Right? And I think it would be really good that once blood got into a capillary, the speed or velocity of it should go down so that it has time to exchange with tissue fluids. All right, so let's take a look at the cross-sectional area. So if we're just going to measure the cross-sectional area of this blood vessel here, and then we get into this capillary, add up all the cross-sectional areas. Right, each individual capillary, the cross-section is very, very small. It's about the diameter of a red blood cell. But if we add up all the millions or billions of capillaries that you have in the body, add all those surface areas together, or cross-sectional areas together, then, right, we see that it becomes very large. It's huge compared to the cross-sectional area of arteries. And then as all of these capillaries anastomose back into a vein, then the cross-sectional area starts to go back down like a artery. All right, so this is where you see that the pressure, like we saw in the previous slide, pressure is not highest in the capillary, but the cross-sectional area, if we add up all the capillaries, is the highest, the total cross-sectional area. Right? And how does that relate to velocity? Well, they're inversely related. So if you have blood flow in the artery equal to blood flow through all of these capillaries equal to blood flow in this vein right here, the only way that all these blood flows will be equal to each other when we increase the cross-sectional area is that the velocity of blood has to slow down in a capillary. All right, so if we then actually plot out centimeters per second versus these different kinds of blood vessels, and so what is centimeters per second? What's a good way of thinking of that? You have that in your car. That's a speedometer, yes, speed or velocity, which we wrote on the board. And can you see that capillaries have the slowest speed and or velocity? Okay. So what blood vessels have the slowest velocity? You'd say capillaries. Why? Because it's nice for blood to be in a capillary for a long time because exchange is going to be taking place there. Right? We don't want blood to get into a capillary and scoot out right away. And so why is that important? That enhances exchange. And that's the whole purpose of a capillary. All right. So that's just something about blood flow and speed. Blood pressure. Arterioles, these small arteries, these arterioles right here, will help regulate blood flow and blood pressure through a number of different kinds of blood vessels. And even distributing blood and controlling blood pressure. Right, and so blood pressure is controlled by the diameter. And so here's a little occluding device. Right, so think of this as a plastic pipe, and we can, with this little thumb wheel, decrease the cross-sectional area, or we can increase the cross-sectional area. And here is the heart. The heart is always going to be applying a certain amount of pressure, and we can sort of mimic that with this system by keeping the level of this fluid exactly the same, right? No matter what happens, let's just keep the level same. If it starts to drop, we're going to put some blood in, right? Or fluid or whatever that is. Okay. So here we have, So here we have some capillaries, right? And I see that we've decrease the radius of a blood vessel right here, what happens to blood flow when that happens? It decreases, right, by that fourth power rule. Okay, so blood pressure is reduced, that decreases the pressure in this capillary bed. While these capillary beds over here are still receiving almost the full pressure from the heart, right? So controlling vasoconstriction, right, proximal to whatever the capillary bed is a way of adjusting blood flow through it, okay, because we can decrease blood pressure. So your book says downstream, right, just distal to this constriction right here, there's going to be decreased blood pressure and decreased blood flow. And when that happens, okay, when we increase this resistance, right, then that increases the pressure in these capillaries, which will increase blood flow over here as well. I think we talked about this one already. Pressure, yeah, we saw this one. All right, here's that cross-sectional area. Here are capillaries. Cross-sectional area is highest in capillaries. And so what does that mean? That means that the velocity is the slowest in the capillary. That's basically what this slide says. Okay. Here is a really important slide. Right, blood pressure is controlled mainly by heart rate, stroke volume, and peripheral resistance. Right, is maintained by blood pressure. Where do we have the highest resistance pressure? Wherever you see the greatest pressure drop. Okay, so I see a really good pressure drop right here in arterioles and capillaries as well, because there are sphincters around capillaries, the pre-capillary sphincters. So in this region right here is where the high resistance blood vessels are. Okay. And if we add up, if we add up all of the arterioles, resistance from all of the arterioles everywhere in the body, and all of the resistance of all the capillaries in the body, right, we're going to call that the total peripheral resistance, or total resistance. And it's peripheral because it's not near the heart, right? It's in the peripheral circulation, not a central circulation. All right, so this statement right here can't possibly make any sense to anybody, right? So I need to show you how it can make sense. All right, an increase in any of these will result in an increase in blood pressure. All right, so what does that mean? What's the relationship of heart rate to pressure? Directly related. What's the relationship stroke volume to pressure? Directly related. What about resistance? If we increase resistance, what happens to pressure? You know what? Let's look at this. An increase in any of these will result in an increase in blood pressure. All right, let's start here. What's the relationship between pressure and heart rate? It's directly related. Yeah. What between stroke volume and blood pressure? Directly related, because an increase in one will cause an increase in the other. And total peripheral resistance is also directly related, right? Because it says right here, increase. So if we increase resistance, we increase pressure. That's the thing that's not intuitive at all. But I wanted you to at least say that. So if we increase resistance, what happens to pressure? Increases, because it is directly related to it. Okay. So let's write that down. And I'll write it down over here. So, what do we got? Blood pressure. Blood pressure is equal to, go ahead, tell me, HR times, what's the next one? It says right there, stroke volume. You're familiar with, you know how to calculate stroke volume times what? Peripheral resistance. And you know what? I'm going to put TPR. Total peripheral resistance. We're going to add up all the resistance of all the blood vessels everywhere in the body. All right, so we see that all of these terms are directly related to blood pressure. So if we increase resistance, what happens to blood pressure? It increases as well. That's not really intuitive, but it is true. All right, so sympathoadrenal activity increases blood pressure via constriction of arterioles. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, why does that happen? Yeah, I want to go over that. I'm dying to go over that, but I can't go over it right now. In like 30 seconds, I can. All right, so vasoconstriction increases resistance, right? And also when we increase sympathetic activity, what happens to cardiac output? That's what the CO stands for. What happens to cardiac output under sympathetic Yeah, it increases. How does it increase? How does the sympathetic system increase cardiac output? Okay, what was cardiac output?
K
stroke volume times heart rate. Okay, so does the sympathetic nervous system have anything to do with heart rate? Let's start there. Yeah, by acting on what? SA node, right? By exciting the SA node. What about stroke volume? That's increasing the contractility of the heart, the strength of the heart. Yeah, and sympathetic nerves go to the ventricles as well. And you saw that before. So sympathetic activity increases both stroke volume and heart rate, right? So sympathetic activity has a positive inotropic effect on the heart and has a positive chronotropic effect on the heart, right? It increases both, so that definitely increases cardiac output. All right, and kidneys play an important role in regulating blood volume, which then regulates blood pressure through venous return. You kind of looked at that already. All right, so you want to know about this relationship right here. All right, so let me turn the light on. First, you have to buy into a couple things. The first thing you have to buy into, and tell me if it's intuitive or not, I'm going to just get rid of what resistance equals to over here. All right. Is it intuitive to you that blood flow through a tube is going to be determined by the pressure from one side of the tube to the other, right? If we increase the pressure, then there's going to be greater flow. But the resistance, right, is going to impede flow. So blood flow is going to be inversely related to resistance. And what did we see was a really powerful way to increase resistance by adjusting the diameter or radius of that particular tube. I think you did that experiment in lab, or you're going to do that, right? So I hope this can kind of be intuitive for you, right? That's the driving force. This then impedes the flow, so that relationship is pretty easy to understand. What about cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate? We kind of derived that before. I think that should be pretty intuitive, right? If we increase heart rate, cardiac output should go up, right? All right. So blood flow through a tube, right? So here we have a blood vessel like this, right? I'm drawing it kind of funny. What does a blood vessel look like? Something like that. All right, so here's blood flow through a blood vessel, pressure divided by resistance. Here we have blood flow through where? The heart. Right, cardiac output is blood flow through the heart. And both of these are what, milliliters per minute? All right, and the other thing we know is that when the heart pumps blood, right, it goes into a vessel, and that the flow through all these blood vessels has to equal flow out of the heart. Otherwise, if there's more flow through a blood vessel, blood is going to accumulate in the heart, and that doesn't happen. Right? Or if blood accumulates here in a vessel, right, then there isn't as much blood going through the heart. So these things have to be equal to each other. Blood flow through a vessel has to equal blood flow through the heart, because that's where the heart is pumping blood, into those vessels. Right? And so since that's true, right, you know what we can do? We can just take those equations and put them together. So what do we have? Pressure divided by resistance. How am I doing so far? Pretty good. Is equal to, oh, I tell you what, let's start right here. It's even a better way of doing this. Blood flow through a vessel has got to be equal to blood flow. And what is this? This is in the heart. Cardiac output is blood flow. So blood flow in a vessel is equal to pressure divided by resistance. Cardiac output is what? Stroke volume times heart rate. So that's the equation that we use. But it's a little cumbersome because I have resistance over here in the denominator. So right now, let's change this resistance to total peripheral resistance, because that's what I like to use. All right, so we're going to just, right? Does anybody have a problem with that? Total peripheral resistance right here. All right, so I want to get rid of, how do I get rid of this term over here? Because we want to just look at pressure. All right, we just multiply it by TPR. But if we multiply it by TPR here, what else we got to do? Put it over here, right? Times TPR. And we're not done, because these things cancel out. And what are you left with? Pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times total peripheral resistance. Right, and we came up with this equation because blood flow through these blood vessels has to equal blood flow through the heart. Okay. So that is the equation. So if somebody says, okay, we need to increase resistance, what's going to happen to pressure? It's going to increase. That's not really intuitive. I would have thought the other way around, but that doesn't happen that way, and this equation definitely tells you it does not happen that way. Okay. All right. So that's what this particular slide is all about. Blood pressure controlled mainly by heart rate, stroke volume, and peripheral resistance. You could look at that over the weekend and maybe ask me next week. You know what? I think I have a YouTube on that, too. I'm sure in Blackboard someplace I have a reference to that YouTube. Or you can just Google my name or something and it will come up in YouTube. Okay. No, don't Google my name and don't Google my name. Go to YouTube and ask for me. There might be a lot of things you don't want to know about me if you Google me. Okay. Okay. Baroreceptor reflex. All right, let's step back a second. What was the most important long-term mechanism for regulating blood pressure? Long-term mechanism? The dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, right? So angiotensinogen converted into angiotensin via renin that comes from the kidneys. Angiotensin 1 is converted into angiotensin 2 by ACE, right? The angiotensin-converting enzyme in the lung. And then angiotensin 2 goes to the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone, and then aldosterone, right, works on the kidneys to resorb water and salt. All right, well, here is the most important short-term regulator of blood pressure. This is not an endocrine reflex. This is a nervous system reflex. We call it the baroreceptor reflex. All right, what's a barometer? You get the barometric reading on the weather every evening. It's a measure of pressure. A barometer measures pressure. And you know what? Maybe in lab. Well, for sure you have a barometer. Maybe you use atmospheric pressure as a correcting factor for some of the measurements that you make, right? So a baroreceptor are receptors that can measure pressure. Okay, so these baroreceptors are in the walls of some arteries, in particular the arch of the aorta, and even more importantly, the carotid sinus. Anybody remember where the carotid sinus is? It's not made a really big deal in the anatomy book, and I'm just amazed, because it's like one of the most important vascular places in your body. Not only does it contain baroreceptors, but it gets sick all the time. It's an area of high disease. All right, so the carotid sinus is where the common carotid goes up into your neck and then bifurcates into the internal carotid and external. It's right at that junction, and it has a funny shape, and because of that shape, it produces a lot of plaques that can break off and go into the brain, for instance, and producing strokes. So that's a troublesome area, but in this particular case, right, it's good because there are pressure receptors. These baroreceptors send action potentials, nerve impulses, to the vasomotor center and cardioregulatory center. And maybe you should remember where those are, where's the vasomotor center and the cardioregulatory centers in the medulla. Not really in the pons, a little bit in the pons, but mostly the medulla. Okay, and then that's where the integration center is. So the medulla then can compare this information to a set point, right, and then make a decision on what to do, and then send that decision out some afferent pathways to adjust blood pressure back to normal, right, and that would be a nice homeostatic mechanism. This baroreceptor reflex is the most sensitive mechanism for controlling blood pressure in the short term, second to second, or even less than a second, and it's most sensitive to decreases in blood pressure. Decreases and sudden decreases, that's the best way to say that, sudden decreases, right? Because if you have a sudden decrease in blood pressure, you might not have enough blood flow to your brain and you might pass out as a result of that. Okay. So this is what maintains blood pressure. All right, so here we have the anatomy of this mechanism. Here is, oh, I didn't know I had this picture. Here is, what is this right here? Oh, it says carotid sinus. There's not even a picture like this in an anatomy book. That's too bad. So here is the common carotid, right, on the right side. Here is the carotid sinus, and this is probably the internal. Here's the external. Here is where we have pressure receptors. There are pressure receptors in the arch of the aorta. And, you know, these things maybe aren't pressure receptors, but they're stretch receptors. And when the pressure goes up, the arteries stretch, and so then the central nervous system gets this information. All right, so these go in through the vagus, and also I think the hypoglossal nerve brings information into the cardioregulatory center, vasomotor center in the medulla, and then the medulla can figure out what to do. And I see two things that it can do. It can send signals out the parasympathetic nervous system or signals out the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so which one is going to be activated if the stretch receptors all of a sudden monitor a decrease in blood pressure, a sudden decrease in blood pressure? That information gets to the vasomotor center, cardioregulatory center. Blood pressure is dropping. What should we do with this parasympathetic activity? Okay, yeah, decrease it or stop it, that would be a really good idea, right? Because parasympathetic input on the SA node and AV node is going to do what? Decrease heart rate in particular, right? It's going to be a negative chronotropic effect on the heart. And what's going to happen to blood pressure if we decrease heart rate? If we decrease heart rate, what's going to happen to pressure? It's going to go down further. That's not maintaining homeostasis. So under those circumstances, medulla is going to choose to send information out the sympathetic outflow. Remember, that is what? Thoracolumbar. See it going right through the sympathetic chain. And the sympathetic nerves go to the nodal tissue, right? The conductile tissue, SA node, AV node. And what's the effect on the SA node? Increased heart rate. So if there's increased heart rate, what happens to pressure? It goes up, and that is subtracting from the initial stimulus. But we also have sympathetic nerves going to the ventricles, which is going to increase force of contraction. What's going to happen to blood pressure then? It's going to increase stroke volume. That's going to increase pressure. All right, so this slide shows two of three important things that are happening. All right, so we talked about heart rate, talked about stroke volume for increasing pressure. What did we not talk about? TPR, and how is TPR controlled in your body? By vasoconstriction or vasodilation of blood vessels. All right, so in this particular case, if there's a drop in your blood pressure, what would the vasomotor center like to do with total peripheral resistance? If there's a drop in blood pressure. If there's a drop in blood pressure, increase total peripheral resistance. What happens to pressure? It increases. How do you increase peripheral resistance? The easiest way of doing it. You don't want to adjust length of a blood vessel. You don't want to adjust viscosity. You want to adjust the radius of a blood vessel. And you do that by increasing resistance. Is it done by constriction or dilation of a blood vessel? Constriction. Yeah, vasoconstriction. I don't see that on the slide too bad. Right, but don't forget about this one. Sympathetic nerves go to arterioles, causing vasoconstriction, which will increase TPR, increase blood pressure. Anybody got a question on that? Okay. All right, so here's a good way to kind of put some of this stuff together. Going from a lying position to a standing position, or even from a seated position that you are at right now to a standing position, there's going to be a sudden decrease in blood pressure, right? And you could probably, even a healthy person might be able to notice that, if maybe you start lying down and then just jump up really fast, and you'll probably get a little dizzy sensation, okay? Because there's not enough blood going to the brain to maintain consciousness at the same level. All right, so changing body position, like going from lying down to standing, decreases venous return, right? Blood is going to pool in your extremities. That gets back to your heart right away. So if there's decreased venous return, what is that in terms of a filling of the heart? Goes down. And we know how the heart fills. We call that what? End diastolic volume. So end diastolic volume goes down. And what happens after that if end diastolic volume goes down? And how do you know that? How does stroke volume go down if end diastolic volume goes down? You would just invoke the Frank Starling law, right? Frank Starling law says that end diastolic volume is proportional to contractility of the heart, right? So as the ventricles stretch, they get stronger, right? So as end diastolic volume increases, the heart gets stronger, and that increases stroke volume, okay? All right. And then if stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up. All right, so here we have So here we have decreasing end diastolic volume, decreasing stroke volume, decreasing cardiac output, then blood pressure is going to decrease. All right, so that is the stimulus when you change body position. Right? Blood pressure is going to go down through this mechanism right here. Fortunately, you have pressure sensors. What do we call those pressure sensors? Baroreceptors. Where do we have baroreceptors? Carotid sinus and arch of the aorta. They're going to send signals where? To the medulla, right? So these, here are the receptors. Here's the afferent pathway into the medulla. And what was the initial stimulus? Decrease in blood pressure. All right. So if there's a decrease in blood pressure and you've got an autonomic nervous system, right, that are antagonistic to each other, what would you do with the sympathetic nervous system? You would stimulate it, and what would you do to the parasympathetic? You would inhibit, right? All right, so increased sympathetic to arterioles is going to cause vasoconstriction. If we vasoconstrict, vasoconstriction, according to Poiseuille's law, is going to dramatically increase resistance, right? If we dramatically increase resistance, what happens to pressure? Increases. Is that what it says right here? Increased total peripheral resistance, increased blood pressure. So far, so good. All right, and if we parasympathetic nerves don't go to blood vessels, okay, but they do go to the heart. And if we increase sympathetic tone on the heart and decrease parasympathetic, what's going to happen to heart rate? Right, if we decrease parasympathetic tone, that's going to increase heart rate. If we increase sympathetic tone, that's also going to increase heart rate. Right. And if we increase heart rate, you know that already. If we increase heart rate, what's going to happen to pressure? It's going to increase, right? But sympathetic nerves also go to the ventricles and increase stroke volume, right, which is going to increase blood pressure. So here we have three things that are increasing blood pressure, and how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Okay, you guys got to tell me. Are we going to be stuck on this slide all weekend? No, you got to tell me. Okay, this is the response, right? Here's the response. What was the initial stimulus? A decrease in blood pressure. How do they relate to each other? They subtract from each other, which is a nice negative feedback mechanism that does what? Maintains homeostasis or a proper blood pressure. All right, so this happens really fast. This is a neuronal reflex, a baroreceptor reflex. And if you want to say anything about the baroreceptor reflex to somebody, what would the first thing you tell them? Oh, you know what? The baroreceptor reflex is the most important mechanism for maintaining blood pressure in the short term, from second to second, right? But if somebody says, yeah, well, I'm not so interested in knowing how blood pressure is regulated from second to second. I'm really interested in the long term. What's the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term? Yeah, the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. All right, so make sure you've got those steps down like that. Okay, well, I thought I was going to talk more about this stuff. All right, so hope, I don't know, look at this equation, derive that equation, be able to derive that equation maybe. Yeah. Oh, increasing sympathetic tone. Increasing sympathetic tone increases heart rate. Oh, no, you have to increase parasympathetic. Did I get something backwards right here? Where were you? Here? Okay. So, decrease blood pressure. We want to increase heart activity. And we know that parasympathetic nervous system is inhibitory on the heart. What do we want to do? We want to excite the heart. So we cut back the inhibitory effects of the parasympathetic nervous system. That by itself will help excite the heart. But remember, the parasympathetic nervous system only goes to the SA node and AV node. It can't affect contractility, only heart rate. So if we decrease parasympathetic activity, what should happen to the heart rate just by this one thing? I tell you, let's start before that. If we increase parasympathetic stimulation on the heart, what's going to happen? Increase parasympathetic, heart rate is going to decrease, right? But if we decrease parasympathetic stimulation, the heart rate is going to increase, go the other way, right? So, and the medulla oblongata has both of these available, both sympathetic and parasympathetic. All right, now here's the beauty of the autonomic nervous system. okay, or any antagonistic nervous system, any kind of antagonistic mechanism. I mean, it can be a molecular mechanism, nervous system, or whatever, hormonal system. Right? What did I always say that antagonism provides for you? What does it give? Precise control and balance. That's really nice. Balance. That's a key term that I want to talk about here. All right, what does that balance mean? Well, what would happen, okay, if we increase sympathetic and increase parasympathetic at the same time? Increase both. What's going to happen? They will cancel each other out, and that's the balanced condition, right? If they both go up, nothing's going to happen. So that's what I mean by balance. Right? They will cancel each other out. So if there's noise, right, if there's some aberrant signal that goes and affects both of these, it doesn't have an effect on your body. That's really important. Okay? Okay. And precise control, because it can control things very rapidly because they're antagonistic to each other. Okay. Was that your question? Sort of? Okay. Okay. Yeah, so decreasing parasympathetic will increase heart rate. If we increase parasympathetic, it's going to slow the heart rate down. Yeah, so there's a lot of things that go backwards to each other. All right, so you know the three hormones. What's another name for antidiuretic hormone? Vasopressin. Yeah, vasopressin. What about atrial natriuretic hormone? What is it acting as? Just like an everyday, yeah, it is. That's how it relates to other hormones. But what's it doing in your body? Atrial natriuretic hormone is acting like somebody said it, I think, but it was pretty meek back there. It's a diuretic, right? It's a diuretic. It was you, I know it was you. Okay, yeah, so atrial natriuretic hormone is a diuretic, and so you're going to lose body fluid, you're going to lose blood volume. If you lose blood volume, guess what happens? Decreased venous return, decreased end diastolic volume, stroke volume is going to go down. Okay. All right, so that's atrial natriuretic hormone, decreasing blood pressure. And then the other two, antidiuretic hormone, right, because we just talked about it. Too bad they didn't call atrial natriuretic hormone a diuretic hormone, right? Then it would make perfect sense. But ANP is a diuretic hormone. It's going to have an opposite effect to antidiuretic hormone. And so what's the relationship between atrial natriuretic hormone and ADH? I heard it. They're antagonistic to each other, right? That's a beautiful thing. All right, so that's why that system works pretty good. But most things in your body are set up to increase blood pressure, okay, unfortunately. And because you don't have parasympathetic nerves going to blood vessels to cause vasodilation, you don't have parasympathetic nerves going to the ventricles to decrease stroke volume, right, then everything is kind of geared to keep increasing blood pressure, kind of setting the groundwork for hypertension. Right, which is epidemic. Okay, how about another question? Any other question on this? Okay, because there's probably a couple exam figures in here someplace. Yeah, this is that one? Yeah, probably this is a good one. We got a lot of little steps right here. Try to understand why these little steps are like that. Okay, so if we decrease venous return, why does cardiac output go down? That would be really good for you to have an understanding of that. Well, venous return, the heart doesn't stretch so much, right? So end diastolic volume goes down. The strength of contraction is dependent on the stretch of the heart. As the ventricles stretch, what happens to the strength of contraction increases, right? That's the Frank Starling law, at least in the ascending limb of Frank Starling law. So if we increase end diastolic volume, stroke volume goes up. If we decrease EDV, stroke volume goes down, so does cardiac output. Okay. So I don't know if people like to think in terms of equations, but these three equations are pretty simple. Right? Maybe on your exam booklet, just jot them down right away, and that might help you. Or even if during the test you want to derive why pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times total peripheral resistance, starting with these blood flow through a blood vessel, blood flow through the heart, that would be good. Okay? So that's it for today. When do we stop? Oh, okay. Okay, so that's it. Was it worthwhile to come to class today? I hope. Okay, even though it was like a kind of short lecture. Okay, here's a good question. One more question. Let's see if I can get back. Okay. Let's see what slide was that? Oh, over here. Ah, here. Okay, so here's that left ventricle. Make sure you put a LV right here. All right, and so the pressure in the left ventricle is what, 120 over zero. It goes to zero during diastole, but when it contracts, it goes up to 120. And the pressure in this aorta right here is 120 over 80. It never goes to zero. And if we take the mean average pressure right here in the aorta, it turns out to be 100 millimeters of mercury. So we're measuring, this 100 right here is being measured, not in the ventricle, but in the aorta. Right? And then the zero is going to be measured in the vena cava. Right? And so that's the pressure, that's the pressure gradient that is driving blood flow through this particular vessel. Okay? Okay. Right. And in this particular case, the length of this tube does not change, but the length of the tube that comes from the right ventricle to the left atrium is really short. So the resistance is less. So if you have a tube with less resistance, but you want to keep blood flow the same, right, because blood flow through the systemic circulation has to equal blood flow through the pulmonary circulation, otherwise blood is going to back up someplace, right? So in order to make blood flow the same, okay, and the resistance of the pulmonary circulation is really low, what do you have to do to pressure to keep blood flow the same? Okay, if this resistance decreases, pressure has to decrease to keep this the same, right? And that's why the pulmonary circulation blood pressure is so low, because it doesn't have nearly the same kind of resistance. Is that what you're sort of asking?
Yeah. I was just wondering.
Yeah, the difference would be between aorta and vena cava. Okay. Okay, thank you. Have a nice weekend.